Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Memcast. I'm Dr. Thomas Bond, and this week I'm joined by Dr. James Taylor, one of the rheumatology consultants at Northampton General Hospital, to talk to us a little bit about septic arthritis. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Taylor.
No problem.
We've got a couple of things to cover on this episode. We're going to talk a little bit about the microbiology, which sort of bugs commonly present in septic arthritis patients and what sort of risk factors patients might have. We're going to talk a little bit about how the patients present and how we come to a diagnosis, what sort of investigations we do in those patients. Talk a bit about some of the differential diagnoses as well. Then we'll go through the treatment that we'd offer and what sort of outcomes we can expect from these patients. So, Dr. Taylor, I was wondering if you might be able to tell us a little bit about the common bugs that we encounter in patients that have septic arthritis and the kind of patients that we encounter that suffer with it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Well, septic arthritis usually refers to any form of infection of the joint, and the most common cause generally is bacterial septic arthritis. You'd find that the majority of infections are caused by Staph aureus or group AB streptococci. They cover the majority of the infections. You can get infections with just about any organism, bacterial, viral, fungal, protozoal even, but they're all very rare, and most of the infections tend to be bacterial. And then in terms of bacteria, there are obviously slightly less common bacteria, the gram-negative, for example, that become more common in patients who are immunocompromised, or older patients, I guess, are also at high risk. And whatever happens to be around in the environment when people are replacing your joints, so that can also be, they can also catch you out. But by and large, the most common tend to be Staph aureus infections to two-thirds. Half to two-thirds will be Staph aureus.
So we're generally dealing with people with Staph aureus in a joint. They may be immunocompromised. They might have prosthetic joints. And as long as we're sort of considering some of those atypical infections as we work forward, we'll probably find the bug that's causing it.
Yeah. So in general, in terms of risk factors, you're looking for people who already have pre-existing damage to their joints or have an artificial joint. You're looking at people whose immunity as a host is compromised, and that includes a huge variety of medical comorbidities, including diabetes, for example, and as well as being properly immunocompromised with drugs. And you also have people who are constantly at risk of introducing bugs into themselves. IV drug abusers, for example, or people who inject for other reasons, be particularly at risk. And then obviously at the extremes of age, your immune responses are not as robust, and that's where you tend to find peaks of incidence in the younger age and the older age groups.
So if we look forward to how these patients present, when we are seeing these patients in the emergency department, when they come in, what are the sort of common findings that we'll get with these patients? Sort of how many joints do they tend to have affected? Where are they affected? What things will we expect to see on your typical septic arthritis patient?
Okay, so the typical vignette, if you like, of a septic arthritis patient would be a patient presenting with an extremely painful single joint. It's usually come on over a period of a few days. It's rarely instant. By the time they present, they're not weight-bearing or moving the joint. And they will often have a fever. Only a small minority will have a high fever, but most unless they're severely immunocompromised, most patients will have at least a mild fever. The joint will be swollen, it'll be red, and there'll be a lot of muscle spasm around the joint affected, so it'd be very difficult to move it. So it'll be severely restricted. And then in terms of investigations, you would have what you'd expect from an infection, a high white cell count, a high CRP, ESR. And if they're really, really septic, then you might expect to find the things that people find with any other form of sepsis. They might have acute kidney injuries, DICs, all those kind of things really that accompany severe infections. Going back to the presentation, generally it's a single joint. In adults, the knee is the most commonly affected joint. In children, the hip tends to be a more affected joint.
We talked a little bit before about some of the other more atypical bugs and things like gonococcus and maybe other rarer causes, even tick bites of Lyme, that kind of thing. Do they present differently or will they present similarly and it'll be more on the investigations that you find out that these patients are presenting with a different bug?
They will usually present with a typical septic arthritis, but the spectrum of presentation is much wider. So with gonococcal infections, usually it's the fact that you're dealing with a sort of young male that alerts you. They may not volunteer the fact they've had a sexual infection, so you have to take a careful sexual history. Even then, they might not know they have it. Again, it's typically a single joint that just goes on and on. It's not usually very virulent, so it can sometimes look like an inflammatory monoarthritis that's been going on for ages and ages, and it's just not settling down whatever you try. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you could have polyarticular presentations with really ill patients. So it's more that they just present in slightly more atypical ways and slightly less usual ways, aside from the what you'd expect. So, as you normally would expect someone that gets ill over a couple of days, these other diseases tend to present over longer periods of time sometimes, or affect slightly odd places.
So those atypical features you think would be sort of a longer and more indolent presentation and potentially multiple joints affected, just to have those other differentials at the back of your mind in those cases is a good thing to do.
Not necessarily multiple joints, but yeah, more indolent. They certainly can present more indolently, as can TB, for example, and Lyme's disease. But as I've said, really, I think in terms of polyarticular disease, that could be any bug causing polyarticular disease. That's more to do with the host, it's themselves. So, older people who have less robust immune systems will tend to present with polyarticular infections, whereas younger patients will tend to present with single joints that are infected.
So if we've got our patient in front of us, we'll go back to our sort of typical one: hot, tender, swollen knee, not weight bearing, difficulty moving it. It's come on over a couple of days. When we come to investigate these patients, you mentioned a couple of things already, some inflammatory markers on the blood tests, but in general, what would the workup be for these patients when they come into the emergency department?
So the key thing really is identifying the infection before you introduce antibiotics, if you're allowed to. And if they're not massively septic, if they have a bit of a fever and a swollen, painful joint, the key thing is to aspirate that joint. There will invariably be an effusion in the joint by the time they present. You should aspirate the fluid and send it for investigation. The things to be wary of, I guess, is that unusual things like gonococcus may not grow in the sort of standard microbial assays. So you might need to make sure that you're evening the odds out by making sure that you ask for the right things. Having said that, you can't ask for gonococcal cultures in every single patient you see, because the microbiology lab might wonder what you're doing. But some of the sort of more chronic and unusual organisms could be a bit more fastidious to grow. So the gold standard is a joint fluid aspirate sent for culture, but even that will miss the diagnosis in some cases. There is really no other diagnostic test. All the other tests are a test of how the infection is affecting you, and they're not specific enough to say it's a septic arthritis.
So really the other investigations that you would do in that case would be more for differentials than for a bug causing a septic arthritis. Is that fair to say?
Yes, and you're looking for additional risks and comorbidities. For example, you might want to know if someone's diabetic, or you might want to know what the white cell count response is, because the higher that is, the more likely it is to be an infection. You might want to do some blood cultures, because most septic arthritic cases are hematogenous spread. So, because if you think about joints, they're privileged environments, they're sealed off from the outside world. So the only way really that infections can get into a joint is if they travel in the blood into your joint and then seed in your joint. So a lot of cases will also have bugs to culture from the blood culture. You might want to look for other sites of infection, another primary focus somewhere else. So they might have a lung abscess, or they might have a primary infection under a toenail, for example. Who knows? There may be a primary site somewhere else that's causing an infection before it spreads to your joint.
If we're looking for some of those other, or suspicious from the history or our examination of some of the other potential causes of an arthritis that aren't your typical bacterial arthritis, not your normal staph or strep, would in those cases we be looking at things like serology? Would you expect that to be helpful in the diagnosis, or are there other things we should be doing to make a diagnosis of, for example, a Lyme disease or maybe a viral arthritis?
Well, like with many things in life, a lot of the serological tests or the immunological tests, they're very context dependent, really. And with microbiological tests, you normally have an IgM serological response and an IgG serological response, and not all labs will have tests for everything that you think of or offer you the correct test either. So you're looking for an IgM positive serology for whatever it is you're looking for. IgG just tells you they've had an infection at some point in the past. IgM tells you it's more recent. But even then, that's not confirmation or diagnostic. With the right context, then it would make sense. So if they've got other features of Lyme's disease, for example, and you do the Lyme serology and it comes up positive, then normally a lab that comes up with a positive test will send it off for confirmation to one of the national reference centers then after that. So you'll get your confirmation, but you'll usually get the confirmation after the event. You still have to act on your suspicions.
In those difficult cases where you might be struggling to identify or work out whether it is a bacterial infection or not, maybe it's a joint that you find very difficult to aspirate, for whatever reason, is procalcitonin something that is helpful to use, or is it something you've ever used personally, or is it mainly going to be off clinical suspicion?
No, I mean, we don't have procalcitonin at Northampton generally. It's just a special test you've got to ask for, especially. It is an indication that you're dealing with a bacterial infection, but that's pretty much it. It doesn't really help you that you've got an acute bacterial infection. You're already suspecting that anyway. It doesn't really help you that much more, I don't think.
Not going to change your management at that point.
No. And I think the management generally is always based on a best guess with your microbiology colleagues supporting likely bugs and then working from there, trying to find something more specific. Because what you don't want to do is sit around waiting for answers to come back, because some of them will take weeks to come back. So if you've got an acutely inflamed joint and you think there's sepsis in there, you've got to deal with that. Whether you actually confirm it or not, in the long run, that's less certain. Hopefully, you'll get the right confirmation come back.
Is there much role for imaging when investigating for septic arthritis?
In the acute setting, very little, really. I guess when you've got prostheses, it might be helpful. You might get clues from there that there's been chronic loosening or evidence of chronic infection before they present. You might want to make sure the bones around the joint are all intact and that there isn't a septic focus in the bone itself. And then imaging for other areas, like we said before, looking for other sites of infection. So you might want to image the chest, for example, to make sure there's nothing there as a primary infection. You might want to consider imaging unusual sites like the spine, for example, for a primary infection that's hidden from view. But that wouldn't be something you do for every patient. So you just be doing it in the right circumstances. For most people presenting, is imaging the joint affected and probably a chest X-ray.
So that, as you mentioned straight away at the start, the key investigation is that aspiration.
The key thing really is thinking about it, to be honest. It's got to be at the forefront of your mind that you're dealing with a septic arthritis and remembering that it is a medical emergency and remembering that you're rarely going to have all the information you need at your fingertips whilst you're acting on it. So whilst you're thinking about all these things that you need to do, you also need to be thinking about getting on and treating this. Time is of the essence, really. There's a significant mortality from sepsis, and there's certainly a lot of permanent disability from sepsis. It very quickly damages your joint beyond repair.
You've perfectly segued into how do we treat septic arthritis there. We'll talk about the differentials a little bit later. As you've mentioned, even though we're doing all these investigations, we're not going to have all the results at the time when we are needing to treat, and we're going to have to be treating as soon as that thought enters our minds. So what is the mainstay of the treatment?
Well, clearly it's going to be antibiotics, really. You're predominantly dealing with bacterial infections. So the first thing you need to be doing is getting all the microbiology tests done and out of the way, so that all the aspirates, all the cultures, culture urine, culture everything, basically, to see if you can find a source of the infection. And then you're talking about antibiotics, and then you have to rely on the sort of epidemiology of septic arthritis. That is, that it's usually a staph or strep infection. So you start with something that's very much going to target those. So for most people, that's flucloxacillin at high dose, and you may want to have additional antibiotics in there to cover a broader spectrum. But I think what is crucial is that you're talking to your microbiologist, because you need to tailor that approach to your local circumstances. There are hugely varying rates of MRSAs and MSSAs around. There are hu hugely varying rates of odd pathogens as well that you might not think about covering. But in general, a strong anti-staph approach with flucloxacillin and maybe something like fusidic acid would be a good start until you start to get culture results back, and then you can be a little bit more precise.
And we've probably alluded to this, but not expressly said it. But when we're aspirating the joint, part of the treatment is draining that joint or getting everything out of that joint that you can. Is that the correct approach here?
Correct. So you need to limit, if it's a weight-bearing joint, you need to limit weight-bearing, because all the inflammatory mediators that are in the joint will make the cartilage extremely fragile and will damage it very, very quickly. So if it's a weight-bearing joint, keep them off their legs, aspirate to dryness. If a little bit depends on in your hospital who deals with the septic arthritis. If it's the medical side, then you would aspirate to dryness at least once a day with a closed needle system with full aseptic technique. And if it's the surgical team that deals with it, then they will take them to theatres and do a washout to take all the stuff out, and they might have to repeat it several times until the effusion stops reaccumulating. So normally once the infection is under control, the effusion stops coming back. If you're doing it by aspiration, you'll get smaller and smaller volumes. And then when there's no effusion to aspirate, then you can start thinking about letting them weight bear if it's a weight-bearing joint.
We'll just have a quick chat about the other things just to consider when we're dealing with a sort of a monoarthritis. What are a couple of the other conditions that you might think about when you get presented with this hot swollen joint?
Right, so I mean, I think, as I said, really, the main diagnostic step to make in making a diagnosis of septic arthritis is to think about septic arthritis. And that's reflected by the sort of teaching mantras over the years that medical students learn, which is the first cause of a monoarthritis is a septic arthritis. The second most common cause of a septic arthritis is a septic arthritis. The third most common cause of a septic arthritis is a septic arthritis. So in other words, you don't deviate from that until you're sure that there isn't a septic arthritis. You can have other forms of inflammatory arthritis presenting predominantly as a monoarthritis, and the typical ones would be the crystal types of arthritis, like gout or pseudo gout. The downside is they can coexist with a septic arthritis. And in fact, a septic arthritis might precipitate an attack of gout or pseudo gout. So you can't, the fact that you find crystals in a joint is not a reason to deviate from your plan that this is a septic arthritis. You might, with experience, decide that, you know, it probably is gout and you should treat it as gout and not a septic arthritis. But that's not something you should be doing when your level of experience is not as great. And the default position should always be that you treat it, you commit to treat it as a septic arthritis until you're sure it isn't. And then, in terms of the more idiopathic inflammatory types of arthritis, then things like reactive arthritis, psoriatic arthritis. Occasionally, patients with ankylosing spondylitis will get single swollen joints that can be quite painful and quite acute. So those types of arthritis can sometimes present with a monoarthritis presentation, but it's not something that will be your go-to diagnosis when you first meet a patient who you've never met before who comes in with a painful swollen joint. That still remains that it's a septic arthritis until proven otherwise. Have I laboured the point enough?
It's number four, septic arthritis, number five, septic arthritis. Perfect. No, that's good. I like it when it's nice and straightforward. So we've gone through, you know, how these patients present, working up the investigations, things we do to treat them. You alluded to this a little bit previously, but assuming we do everything right, how do these patients tend to do when we treat them?
Well, as you would expect, there's a wide array of outcomes. There's about a 20 to 30% mortality rate. It's higher in elderly people and sometimes in very, very young kids, you know, less than 3 months, less than 5 months, where they haven't got a very well-developed immune system. So there is a significant mortality from it. I suppose the most common outcome is some sort of disability long term. It might not be particularly severe. It might be tolerable, and it could range, you know, if you've got a septic arthritis of a knee, it can range from having a mild degree of secondary osteoarthritis. By osteoarthritis, I mean degeneration of the joint as a result of the actual infection. It could be a mild degree, and you know, it might stop you walking 10 miles a day, and you might only be able to walk 5 miles a day, which doesn't seem like a huge disability. But it could equally mean that you're not walking at all because it's so painful you can't stand and walk on it. So it will depend on the degree of damage, and usually that's the result of the virulence of the organism plus the amount of time it's taken to present and be treated. So that's why actually getting on with the treatment is quite important. Delays in treatment result in significant and permanent damage to the affected joint. Upper limb joints tend to be a little bit more forgiving, because you're not walking on them generally. So they're not under compression and loading all the time. So they will tolerate a fair bit of degeneration before you actually notice any major restrictions. Yeah, so I guess it depends a little bit on the site, how many joints, and how long it was before you started treatment.
But as you say, given the significant mortality and morbidity, crucial to get on and treat as quickly as we can to limit that as much as we can.
Yeah, it's not an insignificant mortality, so I think it's important to bear that in mind. It's not because they've got an achy joint that you're treating them, it's because they've got a fair chance of dying from the sepsis.
Well, I think we've gone through a sort of whistle-stop tour there of septic arthritis. I was going to ask you what your take-home points was going to be, but I feel I might be able to
I'll leave you to guess.
some differential one, two, and three of septic arthritis. Excellent.
I think vaguely remember reading somewhere saying the gold standard for diagnosing septic arthritis is the suspicion of an experienced rheumatologist, the clinical suspicion of an experienced rheumatologist. It's generally better in terms of specificity, sensitivity than any test that you could perform, maybe with the exception of a joint aspirate. So I think it's clinical suspicion, and that comes back to the thinking it's septic arthritis until proven otherwise, basically. There's very few orthopedic dogmas that I stick to, but that is probably one of them.
All that remains is for me to thank you very, very much for squeezing me in and joining us for this podcast and sharing your knowledge with us. So thank you very, very much, Dr. Taylor.
I hope it helps. That's good. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. The last thing I'll do is just have a reminder to have a look on our Instagram page at the multiple choice questions we put on, and to keep your eye out for the next episode of the podcast, which will be coming out on Friday next week. Thank you very much.